senior producers are Miguel Gavilan Molina and Kevin Pina. Technical director is Mike Biggs. Our theme music is written and produced by Charlie Lang. For questions, comments, email Dennis Bernstein at dennis@kpfa.org. Thank you for listening.
This is KBOO Portland, volunteer-powered community radio.
Support for KBOO comes from its members and from the Bureau of Labor and Industry's Child Care for Construction, working to provide resources and support for construction apprentices registered with the state of Oregon, in partnership with Business Oregon. More info at oregon.gov/BOLI/apprenticeship under the link Financial Assistance for Registered Apprentices.
Yo, check this out. Hard Knock Radio coming at you, bringing the noise. This is Chuck D, Public Enemy number one, news, views, and hip-hop.
And I am Elizabeth Victor Martinez here with Hard Knock Radio.
Oh,
and you are?
I'm Yuri Kochiyama with Hard Knock Radio.
This is Dolores Huerta, and this is Hard Knock Radio.
Davey D, Hard Knock Radio, hanging out with you this afternoon. Last week, it was Tuesday, that we did a number of shows in the aftermath of what many people see as a historic election, in the face of ICE raids, authoritarianism being attempted to be normalized, a lot of people stressed out and feeling that hope had been taken away. To see the victories that came in Virginia, and the victories in New Jersey, and the victories in Pennsylvania, and the victories all around the country, that was the result of many people who were fed up and felt like, if I can vote, I'm going to at least use voting as a tool to get people who they felt would do a better job and would help turn things around into office. The big cherry on top of the pie was in New York.
And of course,
we saw Zohran Mamdani beat everything that was thrown out against him. And one of the parties that was really responsible for helping deliver that, we have Jane Kim from the Working Families Party. And so in New York, they were pretty active.
Right.
And, you know, definitely should take a couple of bows on on being a part of that momentum. We also have Ethel Longscott from the Women's Economic Agenda Project. And we were due to have you on just to talk about the SNAP benefits. You know, what was happening. You couldn't come on last week. But lo and behold, as everybody is feeling like the momentum is gaining, we're looking at numbers and folks are like, there is a blue wave and et cetera, et cetera. We sat up and watched not one, not two, but eight Democrats sit there and kiss the ring, end the government shutdown with nothing in return. And there is not only anger, but I feel like, just my personal opinion, in the wake of what happened and the momentum and what people were demanding, which was stand down, hold the line, do not move an inch, that this was very intentional to dash hope and
yes.
to kill yes. the spirit and the spirit of a lot of people who had organized. And so I wanted to get you two on to talk a little bit about this. I wanted Jane to come on. But just to give that perspective from the Working Families Party and how you're seeing this dance or this betrayal at this point from the established Democrats. And Ethel Long, I wanted you on because with this happening, with the government shutdown, folks are going to be looking at premiums for insurance, double and triple. And you've been warning us about some of this betrayal for a minute now. So let me start off with you, Jane, because I know your time is kind of short, and I appreciate you taking time out. The euphoria from Tuesday to what we're looking at today on, you know, in the aftermath of this betrayal of the 8 Democrats. Your thoughts on that?
So we had a week where voters said that they were tired of the status quo. They were tired of billionaires running government, that they wanted power back. And we had the electrifying win of Zohran Mamdani, a Working Families Party line candidate in New York City, who actually voted for himself on the Working Families Party line. Probably the first ever in New York City history that the mayor had voted for him or herself on this line. And we had a blue wave across the country, from Virginia and New Jersey to Georgia to Chicago, all the way to California, with the triumphant victory of Prop 50, which was not so much about redistricting as it was a referendum on Trump and what he was doing to cut our healthcare benefits, to cut SNAP, zip tying children and separating them violently from hardworking parents at places of employment or while shopping at Home Depot. And for 5 days after this victory, for 8 of our Democrats to fold was demoralizing and deflating, as if they didn't hear the message that was sent on Tuesday, or maybe they did hear the message and folded.
That's what it seems like.
It feels like there's, as always, a lot of work that remains to be done for us to keep organizing and changing who is in leadership in government. If they're not going to reflect our values, then they need to be out.
Jane, as the Working Families Party, I think in some people's mind, hopefully could be a viable alternative to a Democratic Party that is constantly capitulating or compromising. How have you all seen this? Is this something that you anticipate? And in the wake of this, how do people rebound from it? Is there a path to really continue to move things in a direction that I think people want to go in? How does this shake out?
One thing I will say is that our party membership has more than doubled since November of last year. And yes, we have been doing a lot of the work to grow our party and to organize and to, here in California, elect over 100 endorsed candidates to office, from school board to state legislature. But part of why we have grown so much in the last year is really thanks to the Republicans and Democrats. We are seeing the dissolution of a two-party system that I'm not sure I ever thought I would see in my lifetime. And voters feel it, they smell it, they see it. They see the crumbling of this two-party system, and they see a system that is not working for working people at all, because billionaires and billionaire corporations have captured both parties.
Right.
And if big money is central to how you believe you stay in power and governance, then you cannot ever truly represent working people all of the time. And that's what we have seen. And that became really crystal clear this past November, and that has continued to be clear throughout this year. There are individual Democrats that are fighting for working people.
Right.
But the party is not fighting for the people anymore. And so we absolutely need an alternative. This current system is not working for us. A two-party system does not give working people the ability to maneuver electorally. And so having a corporate-free container, which is what the Working Families Party is incredibly important. Again, because if having billionaire corporations at your table is critical to you winning governance, then you can't ever truly represent working people all the time.
I want to bring in Ethel Long Scott, but I want to ask you, Jane, Kim, if you can put on your, you know, people forget that you held office and you've been in these circles, you know, as supervisor and all that in San Francisco. When people hear you say that they're captured, can you describe the type of conversations or the type of obstacles that somebody who is holding office comes across? What are they saying to a Jane Kim who's holding office that would get Jane to say, you know what, I know everybody voted for me to do A, but I'm going to do B? You know, I mean, what? How do they get in that position?
I think it starts before you get into office. It starts when you're a candidate. And if you are either, it's not just about accepting contributions. It's about whether you perceive that you need the wealthiest in our country to contribute to your campaign in order for you to win and to stay in office. And I think that is the calculation that we are seeing all Republicans and many Democrats making today, that they cannot win without big money. It is more expensive than ever to run for office. However, we still are seeing examples of where people rise up and propel their candidates to either great popularity, like Bernie Sanders, or even win office, like Zoran Mandani. And so it is, the lesson learned is that we absolutely can beat money. And it's not that billionaires shouldn't have a seat at the table, right? They can have a seat at the table, but they can't run the table. Like, we understand that employment and jobs and companies can provide a great service to our country, right? And some of these are things, whether it's housing, pharmaceuticals, hospitals, these are all things that we continue to need, but they should have a seat at the table, not run the table. And that is the problem that we are seeing today, is that as Democrats and Republicans capitulate to billionaire corporations, it is because they think they only need them to be in governance.
And so now it looks like there's going to have to be a lot of more organizing. Ethel Long Scott, let me bring you in. As I like to say, this ain't your first rodeo. I don't know if you've ever seen these types of dances before.
No.
But to see what happened on Tuesday, to see what happened in New York in particular, and to see this capitulation, you know, just hours afterwards, what runs through your mind? You said you haven't seen this in the moons that you've been organizing and on the ground and doing this work.
Few fights.
Yeah.
A few fights. I really appreciate you and Jane and your work. Let me just say that. And really, even as an old head in this, we really are living through times that none of us have ever lived through before. Obviously, I've studied many different pieces and it's informed my work. But when I look at essentially what the establishment politicians, I would call them corporate Democrats, did, was they essentially affirmed that managing inequality is at best what they do. And for them, they literally can't, they traded off maybe their strongest position to be able to get something done without getting anything in return. Who does that, right? And so I think that there's that, but I also think based on the components, and maybe the audience is already right there with us, but I want us to touch base on this. What was so powerful amongst the things that happened in New York is that there really is a this movement for, quote, affordability. Many in my circles, we talk about it in terms of basic needs, housing, transportation that is affordable, childcare, and of course, food. Healthcare would be right there in the integral part of that. And that was a part of what was happening even in this debate, because we all know once those ACA
Affordable Care Act.
Yes, Affordable Care Act. Once those
premiums
start hitting, families are going to be paying, they could pay anywhere from $600 more per month to thousands of dollars. And I mean, this means basically people will not have health care and or the condition that we had before, where if you have pre-existing conditions, i.e. diabetes, i.e. pre-existing blood pressure, the insurance companies don't even have to take you any longer. A lot of young people in Jane's generation may not even be aware of that, right? And that's the weird, I mean, basically everything to serve corporate dictatorship. And so it's very obvious to people when you're looking at, you know, what, you know, that we got a lawless cabal that's running things. These constitutions, monstitution, whatever you want to go with, they essentially make the rules. And they have the backup and enforcement. And it's so powerful that people have turned out in demonstrations and protest. But also, there was a motivating factor that the Mandami campaign facilitated, and it brought out young voters. It brought out old people like me who'd sat on the side in the past election who said, there's not a reason for me to vote. Those Black men and Hispanic men who might have either set out or even voted for Trump, he went to them. He talked to them. ask them, why did you vote last time for Trump? I love that about him. I love, that's a warrior for me, who was not going to be set aside by, you know, but really, and he listened. And that's how he got to this other part. And I think this movement aspect for a movement for we have a new path. And I think that's why those establishment politicians did what the hell they did. They wanted to douse water on our overall effort and discourage us into believing that working class people could have power, especially when we come together. So there's some important lessons. There's lessons in going forward. And we have to keep in mind, we didn't ask for this war that is being made on us, but it is being made on us. And we need a strategy and a way to fight forward to change this.
You know, to both you, Ethel, and Jane, when we did our analysis of the show last week, over and over again, it was echoed that there would be a backlash, that folks are going to pull out all the stops to undermine, right? I think many people hearing that thought that it would be, you know, the bombastic way, the Donald Trump, who's like, I'll take away all the money from New York and I'm going to send ICE in there and yada, yada, yada. And we may have overlooked the fact that there were corporate Democrats that really hated what happened in New York as well. We kind of forgot that Hakeem Jeffries waited to like the 11th hour, you know, like that morning, like at 6 a.m. He goes, yeah, Mandami, and, you know, and everybody else, you know, I don't know if Chuck Schumer and them ever came around, but they were resentful of that, and to the point that they were willing to put up their own serial sexual abuser and get behind him in the form of Andrew Cuomo, right? Mm-hmm. And pull out all the stops to try and stop them. So this victory was one that while we relished in, they seemed to be very angry. With that being said, we kind of had that euphoric moment when Obama won in 08, right? And we talked about it last week. A lot of people said he will handle it, and, you know, and he didn't. And so the lesson is now we have to stay active. We have to, you know, keep that thing going. Now you have to plan out and keep that coalition together and not allow it to be broken up. So I guess the question is, how does one do that moving forward? I know it's new terrain, but I'll start off with you, Jane. How does working families keep that enthusiasm going, keep people in a fight, if that's what it is? And I guess what I meant to say, what happened with Obama is that we got so used to fighting to get somebody into office, we didn't necessarily figure out how you fight to make sure that the entire team and policies that we want are allowed to stay, you know? And so that's where we're at now with the Mandami thing, is like, how do you do that? How does working families maintain this, you know, because the fight was to get him into office. He's there now, in theory, so what next?
One of the key lessons that we learned during the Obama presidency is that it is critical to keep the organizing going throughout someone's term. And so, you know, I supported Obama in 2008, not because I thought he was progressive. I knew he was pretty centrist in his politics. My hope was that he would be able to continue to invest in the organizing infrastructure that he had built during his 2008 campaign, and in particular, the hundreds and thousands of young people that were inspired to engage, organize, and vote. Now, if we could have kept that momentum going through the ACA fight, I think we would have won a different ACA package, ultimately.
Yeah. Can I say something on that real quick? Just not to cut you, but I'm glad you mentioned that. What I saw was once he got in, he didn't want that organizing effort going. We were talking last week that everybody went to the White House because they brought all these people in, and we sat there and it's like, I'm going to hire you. And he hired like a lot of key people and put them in a position where they couldn't, really do stuff. So, but you know, that's just something, you know, we can get into that, but That was the mistake. We didn't keep organizing. Go ahead, Jane. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to cut you.
No, you didn't. I wasn't on the inside at the White House, so I don't know what decisions were made, but I did see that the investment in the organizing infrastructure did dissipate over time. And I will say, someone who spent 12 years in office, one of the key things that my office did was to continue to organize our communities to come out, to have regular meetings with them on the legislation and policies and the actions that they wanted to see government take, and to continue to bring them out to hearings so that my colleagues could hear from them and hear why certain budgetary allocations and policies were so important. We were the most prolific legislative office my 8 years on the Board of Supervisors, not because I had a majority on the board. I didn't. I was a minority on the board for 6.5 out of the 8 years that I served, but because we organized our neighborhoods and communities to come out. I represented one of the poorest neighborhoods in San Francisco, the Tenderloin neighborhood. And over those 8 years, I soon represented the wealthiest zip code when tech began to grow in the south of Market and in Mission Bay. And so it was incredibly important for us to continue organizing and also to organize on issues that brought our communities together. So one of my top issues was Vision Zero and pedestrian safety, because this was an issue that equally impacted our wealthy neighborhoods like Mission Bay and South of Market that hugged the 80 and the 101, and it impacted the Tenderloin as well. We had the highest rates of pedestrian vehicle collisions in the city in both of these neighborhoods. So we also continued to find issues, identify issues that brought all of our communities together so that they would sit in the room together and sit with each other and figure out how to make the community better together. But the organizing piece is key, and I think that will be key for Zoran Mamdani's office, is to keep that momentum going, keep all those young folks and older folks that are inspired, because the way he's going to win is by everyone being a part of the process. It's not just the outcomes that you win. It's the it's also
exactly
the process. That is part of the win.
If I might add, and I know you may have to depart, but I think that one of the things that I understand is that what is growing at this time is a movement that actually is already beyond New York. When I look at someone like Brandon Johnson in Chicago, he's a product of Harold Washington. And anybody, if you really talk with them, they're continuing a 4-decade-old legacy that and promise that they understood they had to be a part of helping to craft. And it was battered down under several administrations. But when you look at what CTU and Brandon Johnson have done together, it's really to hold up this flame that government either can be for helping to serve and address the needs of the people, or it's going to be for extraction and for profit making. And at every step along the way, this is where I see the connection with your organization, Jane. You all are coast to coast, but you're not necessarily in every state. But what you do represent for us is that you are an important distinction and alternative to two parties that are captured by the billionaires. There is no room for people such as myself and the people who I've fought for all of my life. So I think that this crucial question about working class power and how do we approach that? How do we build something really beyond even coalitions? Because a part of that strength that came out of those things, we're seeing that here in Oakland. It's small. We have one council person who is, stalwart, Carol Fife. And they have spent so much money trying to get that young woman out of that office, and she stands with the poor, come hell or high horses, she's there. So I think that we got to make those links with political parties like yourselves and our movements. Yeah. That's all I wanted to be able to say to you before you left.
Jane, I know we have to let you go. I'll let you respond. And just quick question with that. Do you use the anticipated high rates that people are going to have to pay for premium? Did that become an organizing tool for working families and others now? Did that become something to remind people and get them to rally around?
And I know Ethel is deep in the healthcare coalition war. And healthcare is a right. And that is something that when you knock on doors, everyone agrees with this. No one believes that healthcare should be on the private capitalistic market. Everyone deserves care in the wealthiest country in the world that can afford to provide it. We all deserve equal care. And so, yes, I do think, you know, we all call it the everyday pocketbook issues are a rallying cry. And in fact, you know, one of the reasons why I think Prop 50 won by such a lopsided margin in California is that people saw that with the election of Trump, that grocery prices continue to rise, that services and other costs continue to rise, that he hadn't actually impacted their pocketbooks. And once they see their premiums rise as well, I think that is going to be, you know, I think the voter backlash in 2026 of the Trump administration could be very strong. And that's why they're trying to cheat. That's why they're doing redistricting.
Yes.
They already know that their policies aren't popular. You know, this is a thing actually we all agree on.
Yep.
Everyone wants healthcare. Everyone wants to be able to afford a dignified life with one job. They want to be able to work one job and be able to have a home. They want to have security. They want groceries. They want healthcare. And we should have that in this country. We all agree on that. And so this is the vision that we need to build as a party, and understand that this work is daily. There's never a day that we just win and it's over. And Ethel, that's why I think the continuum, the arc of understanding this movement work is so important, especially for those of us that are younger, is to understand that so that we know how to keep going. I know I could have never run for office if generations of ancestors had not fought and died so that women of color could one day run for office and actually win. And so that continuum is important for us to understand. The fight is not just a singular moment or a day. It is something that we as a society decide that we all are committed to making sure that we are all okay.
Absolutely.
Jane Kim, we appreciate you taking time out.
Thank you.
Will look for you, Working Families Party. You headed up here in the West Coast, or at least in the Bay. So thank you for joining us. She had a ton of meetings and took time out. So we appreciate you.
Appreciate you for that. Yes.
Thank you. And we have in-person holiday parties all throughout California. December. So please check out our site and join us.
Yes. Okay. Yes, indeed. Thank you. Later.
Davey, something that you, I know you know it, these pocketbook issues, I call them affordability basic needs, but that the electricity rates in Chicago, in Georgia, helped to put two Democrats in office where they haven't had a Democrat in a state held office in I think 20 years, two decades, and it was the guys that have been on before have watched the rate increases more than 10 times during their period. I think that this is an important anchor. Whether you're in the, what I call, corporate parties or outside of them, they can be rallying calls. But I think we have to think about them as both motivators, but they're the building blocks. And we're having similar here in Oakland, we could say around PG&E, my goodness, we could get more than a city involved with that, right? But this question of the people who have been impacted, putting forward solutions, not unlike what has been raised about, freezing the rents, but it's been providing direct shelter, the fight around what happens with Measure W. I hope you'll have a show on that in the future. These are really, these are things that are opening up a new path for which way governance will go. And I think that our city is playing a disproportionate role, much like what is being done in Chicago and in New York. And I think that that's why we're under threat for occupation by our illustrious president, and along with the history of resistance in our city.
Right. Well, a couple of things. Ethel Longscott, who is still with us from the Women's Economic Agenda Project. Couple of things to say. First, I like the fact that you use the term affordable. What is that term?
Affordable. Affordability and basic needs. Really.
Yeah. I think when you put that, when you say that, that hits home. You know, what is affordable? And that's a word that has not been used. You know, we talk about it in lofty terms, but, what is really affordable to the average person is not, it's not really spelled out. Because remember, they was like, we're going to get, we're going to have non-luxury apartments for you. But in order for you to get those non-luxury apartments, you had to make $100,000 a year, right? And nobody's talking to the people that make $30,000 and $40,000, et cetera, et cetera. So I think that's a good thing to remember, what is affordable. But the other thing that I think has happened is that hope has been dashed from the perspective of, I don't think I'm ever going to be a millionaire.
Right, right.
You know, and even if I am, it don't mean nothing in the Bay Area anymore. And I'm certainly not going to be a billionaire. I didn't win the lottery, so that's not going to ever happen. And I say that very seriously because there's a number of people who felt that they could one day join this path. And I think what's happened is, like, at the end of the day, people just want to be comfortable. I feel like if I want to go to the store and I want to, you know, buy me, you know, some extra food for the holidays, I should be able to do that. If right. I want to go out to dinner like we did the other night, I should be able to do that and it doesn't break the bank. I think people want those basic things versus, like, gee, I wish I had 75 rooms that are gold plated in the hills somewhere. Right. You know, that's some crazy stuff there, you right. know, but right. I just want to be able to live comfortably, you know, and that's gotten out of whack. And as these prices come down the pipe, along with the tariffs, right, that are affecting it, people are going to see that, man, you know, I don't even have hope that I can afford an apartment, right. you know, in a decent neighborhood now. And even in a non-decent neighborhood,
right, you, know, thank you.
You can't get those anymore. And so that has left a lot of people despondent, which is why I think we saw the response that we saw. But now it's going to be up to folks to give them a reason to fight and a target to really go after. That's what I think this betrayal with the Democrats was about. Like, I'm going to crush your spirit and leave you despondent and paralyzed. And maybe I'll gaslight you.
Yes.
And it's
yes.
going to be up to organizers not to allow that to happen. And to remember those.
To anticipate that it will happen and do the political education beforehand to say, you know, well, let's reaffirm, what are we trying to get done? What's really our vision? What kind of country and world do we want to live in? I tell you, it's bad. I've seen a lot of bad things, but watching masked men running around being paid on our dollar to snatch up anybody. Profiling is now being reaffirmed as a part of formerly as a part of the law of the land. We, you know, as a Black woman, we've seen this story before. We know how that plays out. And I think the question for many of our neighbors and family and friends, oftentimes we actually are shouldering the financial burden when one or another family member doesn't have anywhere to live after working all their lives, and we become that place for shelter, or our son or daughter have to also do that. We're seeing that happen, but it gets talked about in private terms. We think about it as our individual kind of thing. We have to figure out how to work around it, but millions of people are going through that same thing. This isn't just individual. This is a system problem, and it gets played out in our personal individual lives. So we have to participate. There's more impetus for us to be involved with making the kind of change for the world that we want to see and that we need.
Let me ask you this. I lost my train of thought. Let me just get it for a second. Man, oh man, oh man. This is the first or second.
That's okay. Yeah. Something I was thinking about is that it's so normal for us in our country that MAGA billionaires would be structuring what the conversation should be. And what's so powerful about the 7 million that turned out and the protests that have gone on in Chicago, I was so heartened. I mean, and they continue. There's probably a young man that you're quite familiar with, Vic Mensa. From Chicago, I love him, but I think of him. He might be your contemporary or a little younger, but he, you know, he just keeps it very straightforward. You know, keeps it raw. He talks about the challenges that, you know, Black and Brown communities oftentimes are miseducated to believe that we're one another's enemy, and here we're all of a sudden confronted with what these realities, and then touching back with that history that we need, that Hampton worked on, his brilliance that Fred Hampton worked on. And that, for me to see that this generation making those very important ties a direct challenge to the notion that billionaires are going to negotiate something that's going to benefit working people. Somehow this point, it's really significant, David. And I think we're at that movement building time, something that Reverend Barber speaks a lot about. But I think that there's more intention, and the importance of building unity between our movements is crucial at this juncture, that in terms of working class unity. So I talk in some circles with young people or any people about the importance of race and class analysis in as we approach this work. And I think it's even more if we are doing it beforehand, so that when the oligarchs play these kind of actions that they did to undermine our efforts, we can anticipate and we can regroup. We can build back from that, build with other leaders, and that we're not discouraged to just kind of walk away.
That's the voice of Ethel Long Scott. Now I remember what I was going to ask you.
Good.
So thank you.
I knew you would.
And you actually triggered a few more things. First, let me just, this thing about unity, what has happened over the past few years is the amplification through social media of putting people in silos, and people from their respective demographic, if you will, demonizing somebody from another. And so, you saw this in glaring fashion when the ICE raids first started. Yes. And I think many Black people were shocked to see that when you went on social media, there was a whole bunch of folks that were like, yeah, let ICE come. This ain't our problem. This ain't our fight. And then they held up the voting stats, which have been since disproven, about all these Latinos voting for Trump, right?
Right.
And it was curious to me initially, like, why are these people on my feed and where they're coming from? And then slowly but surely, you started to see that these were literally paid for. This was a grassroots organization, and it was like planting a seed. Well, if you said it, I'll say it. And then, people that you do know would echo that. But initially, this happened. And I think when we did the show in Chicago, one of the guests lived right across the street from that building that was raided.
Oh, my goodness.
And two things that they told us. One, the quote-unquote gangs that they were looking for, first of all, they looked just like us, right? He said they were coastal Venezuelans, so they have dark skin and afros and the whole nine. Said they had bounced and hadn't been in that part of town, for months now, right? And so it was just regular, ordinary folks that had Chicagoans who were the ones that were being checked. But then you saw videos, and there was one particular one with a sister that was standing in front of the building saying, we need this. And they were like, man, she don't live here. The guests were like, this is a plant. This is somebody. And they tell us that they have an operation in Chicago
of
Black MAGA folks, right?
Yes, like, yes.
They had a name
for it. Just like we got Black MAGA.
Right.
Yes.
So the point is that part of their rhetoric was to sit there and say, we don't like Latinos, we don't like Asians, we don't like this. So they have this kind of nationalist, nativist type of thing.
Yes.
Right? But then when you look at their policies, they're like, yeah, we need ICE. Like the sister, we need ICE to get rid of these illegals. And you're like, where'd that come from, right? And then they had a similar type of situation in D.C. Mm-hmm. And so when you start talking to people, then you realize these are bought and paid for, some of them being supported by tech money because they were being amplified on social media. And then you start talking, which I think it becomes important, you start talking to other folks, and it's like, man, we got a similar type of situation in our community, right? So in Asian communities, you got these conservative folks that are calling people like Jane Kinn bobo heads and coconuts and all that. So they use nationalistic terms. And then when you check out their policies, a lot of times they're either anti-Black, anti-immigrant, and all this stuff. And so they've been able to silo folks.
Yes.
And when people were out in the streets talking, either around Prop 50 or in New York around what was happening with the Zorhan Mandami race or in these other places, then you start to realize, oh, we've been duped, and everybody has in their community, you know, these operatives
that are
showing up, you know, wearing dark glasses and talking, you know, using movement and militant terms, policies or anything but. It's like black power, more police.
Yes. I mean, they take and turn the public safety issue on its head.
Yes.
And pretend that if we have that these measures, and I mean, it's very interesting, right? Because I don't know who could argue that the cities that are occupied presently have more safety, be it LA, DC, or Chicago, as we speak. And I guess we could say probably the same thing for Portland, but they got a judge up there that is, you know, at least they're making judicial measures to try and back off this lawless grouping. But this cabal doesn't really care, because since they're trying to rip up everything, they're like, well, no, only our laws count. I think your point is we're at this stage. It's actually a stage of development in capitalism, and it's you know, with the, you know, one what is it, Naomi Klein describes it as end stage capitalism. And I think that it's important. We think of it only in terms, some people think of it only in terms of climate or only in terms of finances, but we're talking about, it's a whole sea change of the system. And we're seeing it with, you know, these billionaires and technocrats. They don't need us in the paid workforce. Is it crazy Mr. Trillionaire Man says, well, by 2030, there's not going to be those jobs around any longer. So they want social and political policy that essentially throws us out, that doesn't feed, clothe, house, and provide for people. So we can't fight that individually. And in our brains, we keep trying to fight it individually. We got to open up our heads and be like, we've done, you know, educate ourselves and build networks. But our strength is in our unity, right? And this is so crucial. I mean, our strength is in our education and are working together towards a different vision, because these folks are working towards a vision. And I think you're right that they are, I mean, we have proposals on the city council to essentially erase 7,000 people from the streets of Oakland for the crime of being homeless.
Yeah,
and we did shows on that. Putting that mess forward. It's not somebody else is putting it forward. And I think that if we aren't informed, you can be quote unquote bamboozled. With brother Malcolm, I don't know what do we think about these electronic states, but it was a great word because it covers a lot of different things, right? But that's exactly what they're, you know, you guys call it, I think, gaslighting now, but I think you might have did something a little different related to it similarly in a different period.
Well, you know, as you're talking about that, maybe you remember when the crime bill came out.
No.
At the height of the crack epidemic.
No.
And there were a lot of black mayors that were actually behind it. They won't admit it now, but you know, I remember we did a bunch of shows.
Love you for that.
We did a bunch of shows on that. Mm-hmm. And we had Jesse Jackson, who at that time was very clear. He was against it, and it was naming names, you know, Kurt Smoke and Toomey and Fume and all these guys, right? They were gung ho. But if you go back, tell me if you remember, I recall them making the case that you were anti-black if you didn't support the crime bill. They were telling the Clintons and all that, right? Right?
And didn't people, Clinton use and, that yeah, right. as their argument? Yeah, they said, we don't know why people were attacking us. We defended them.
Yeah.
We defended
so the whole thing about the super predatory thing, which he did say, was in the backdrop of all these reactionary folks who are saying, if you don't get these predators out of our community, then you don't have a love for black folks. And because it wasn't intentional conversation, and I think Charles Barron talked about, you weren't reaching into the totality of the community, right? Then what you had was a gaslighting, if you will. It's like, well, you know, I talked to these folks and this is what they said they wanted. And you see similar things. So you can have an NAACP say, we need more police, right?
Yes.
Which is like, where'd that come from? Because you were the ones that were saying stop and, you know, all that sort of stuff. And so it now requires people to have more nuance and surgical precision, politically speaking. Otherwise, you can be really led astray by somebody who looks just like you.
Yes.
And you use similar languages, but have
I think many of the young people are really promoting that they need, that there needs to be an intergenerational approach in this, in our movement building. I know I don't want to convince you and maybe many of your listeners, but that's, they're saying they can read the historical aspect, but it doesn't necessarily tell them, okay, so we got X, Y, and Z achieved, but at this juncture, a different money and power interceded in a different way to thwart and undermine, for my purposes, Black liberation efforts. Right. And in those instances, it was done sometimes in blackface.
Yeah.
And it undermined exactly or redirected, even worse than undermine, the effort for liberation and moved it into the category of accepting our subjugation. So these are really important parts of what we're, but I think that there is an awakening, Davey, that people from a lot of different backgrounds. I was so impressed around the Palestinian effort, these young people,
Jewish Voices
people,
for Peace,
yes,
and
yeah,
JVP.
I mean, I was like, whoa, where did this come from? And it was so powerful, right? And I know they have caught hell. Anybody was in any, on any campus, I don't know how they'll ever get work until we have some radical change. But they were really bold and they did not back down. I just think that these are some important new developments, just like the new path of kind of organizing that we need government to be, that serves public, that public wealth and resources needs to be applied to public good. That's really what we're looking at, the Mamdani, the, what's the significance of that? What's the significance of what Brandon Johnson's doing? What's the significance of the work here in Oakland? And it is it's a different path than simply saying, let's get the bums, these set of bums out and get these other people in. Nope, we're talking about a whole different criteria.
Right. And to your credit, I know you're on a long thread with a bunch of people who are in that cadre of quote unquote youngness, Hip Hop Congress and all those folks. So you stay abreast. But as we close out, the other thing that I was going to ask you was, you can reward people with crumbs. So I know there's a lot of people who were down with Trump because of the whole Bitcoin thing. Mm. And so they were making money that way. So they felt like, I'm getting paid, right? You kind of saw a glimpse of it when Snoop went to the Bitcoin party right around the time that the inauguration was happening. But there's a lot of folks that, you know, when you talk to them, it's like, brother, I'm getting paid. You know, I've got these Bitcoin going thing. And so they have that. But what it reminded me of, but from looking at the things with President Nixon, right? Didn't he have James Brown and all these entertainers, right?
Yes.
That came along and said, man, we're making money.
Jr.
And they were talking about that they were promoting black capitalism, where we can make our money under here. And Nixon was like, I'm gonna give you all these opportunities to get paid. Yes. And so that getting paid became the narrative that was supposed to kind of undermine the black power rhetoric. Like,
and you
hear even people like Brown saying, you know, black power, I'm about green power, baby. It's about green power. Green power, get that green power, and then you can do what you want. And so in some way, I think this is the play. Like, let's get a few of these people, influencers, because remember, let's get these influencers into the White House. Let's pay them, right?
Yes.
So then all of a sudden, things are good for them. Let's pay some of the folks that are in our community. Let's get them, you know, Bitcoined. And then just to top it off, we'll take these tariffs and we'll give everybody a $2,000 check, you know, so you can pay for the goods and services that went up $300, $400. But that's a whole other thing. But giving people those crumbs,
right,
when you're talking about trillionaires and billionaires sitting in the White House, it seems to be the play.
And also, let's not forget, what they're doing with government is making it serve the oligarchs of billionaires. And so they're trying to make us believe, and with all the firings, you know, your wonderful show, we talked about the layoff of black women as a significant part of that cadre, 300,000, likely more by now, who had been fired and now in and luckily furloughed in furlough and they may lose their jobs at any rate. But our point being that they want to change who is, quote, big government. And I think that that's an important part to remember. So they're trying to restructure, tear down, restructure, and redirect that it's only really for like another money-making venture, as opposed to if it's an, if government is to serve the 340 million people, and to and if resources are be, that's going to be a fight that we are, if we can, you know, name it, every place that that is confronted directly, we can win that fight. But when it's hidden under, well, you know, if this or that individual makes it, then we all, the rest of us, are supposed to shut up. No, we're not supposed to shut up. We're talking about the safety and well-being of the vast majority.
Well, that's what they tried to do with the Target strike. Remember, they trotted out a couple of people, said, I'm a vendor in Target. Don't boycott. No, hell no, we're boycotting.
Yes.
As we close out, you know, I'll let you get some last words. But,
oh, no.
Yeah, but, you know, let people know how they can get a hold of you. But one of the things I was thinking about with this Affordable Care Act, it's still against the law if you don't have it. And so my biggest fear is that as they raise these premiums, you know, they may overlook, you know, Mr. Smith from down the street and Mr. Jones in you know, Tootaloo, Alabama. But they may go, Ethel Long Scott, the activist, you don't have health insurance, and that's against the law. And all of a sudden, you know, you have a problem. Because remember, that part of it was everybody had to have it, which is why they were giving the subsidies in the first place. I think, you know, the way the cruelty of this administration has been, that they would weaponize those who can't afford, you know, these high premiums that will be coming in January. They'll weaponize it and say, well, you violated the law by not having it in the first place.
Yes, I think that if we've been talking a lot about newly elected Mayor Zohran Mamdani. And one of the things that he's really so good at is that we need to make sure that we are clear about what, and so what you just described was what I call criminalization of working people, poor people. And remember, already in this big ugly budget that got passed, it's really a Gestapo force through the ICE, the largest force now. It's larger than many countries' military, and it can put any of us in cages. So maybe my cage might be because I don't have insurance, or your cage might be that you happen to be hungry, or the other cage might be that you don't have, that you look a particular way. But the point is, we need to organize now before those and stop establishing those cages for ourselves, because that's who it's for. It's not going to be for no multimillionaires and billionaires. It's for working people of this country. So I think that operating with that sense of clarity and purpose, that we need to restructure the economic future that we need now. That's the key thing. How do we get it? So, you know, I work with all kinds of folks, but one, I work very closely with the Laney College Poor People's Campaign, and you can reach us at humanrights1@icloud.com. I work with a number of other, I've been able to work with a wonderful network of Black Power to Trump's Fascism Network. It's really very doing some important work here in our city and in the region. But I also think that obviously I work, you know, obviously with Hip Hop Congress, and that's how come I get hooked up or learn about people like the Vic Mensa's. Yeah. You need to have him on at some point. He's a brilliant guy.
I've been trying to get him on. If you can get him on, we'll make it happen.
I think he's always talking about his baby.
Yeah.
So I think he's definitely trying to get some dollars. But I think also he's an excellent teacher for this period. And everything we can do to link up these efforts between our generations is so crucial. Thank you for your work, brother. Appreciate it.
Well, we'll have you back. We're going to take a break here on Hard Knock Radio.
Okay.
We'll be right
back. Thank you. All right.
Someday we're going to win this war. Someday we're going to do better. These are the reasons. Now I'm craving our freedom. This is a real pressure is rising, we're forced to feel I'm not the one to ever kneel,
never kneel.
I'm burning with fury, nowhere feels right. Chains on our spirit, but still we unite. We'll tear down these systems and rise in the fight.
We gonna rise. We gonna rise.
The reasons, the reasons.
Hi, this is Walt Perezeta with the group Chicago, and you're listening to KBOO FM.
This is Bird Note. As he trained to be an arborist, Thomas Pulsum started developing two new interests. The first was birds.
My favorite bird is a robin, robin redbreast in Europe. Because when you're digging, a little robin is always following you around looking for food. Worms and grubs and all sorts of things that you're digging up.
The other was building with Lego bricks. After a dark age away from the toy while at university. And then, Thomas found these interests colliding.
I wanted to build something related to my work. And I had a eureka moment, which was a robin landing on my fork handle. So I thought, right, I'm going to build a robin out of Lego.
After building that European robin, he built more bird models and a name for himself in the Lego community. To date, he's made more than 75 species. And in 2015, Thomas was one of the first Lego fans to have his designs produced as an official set. It included a blue jay, a hummingbird, and, of course, a robin.
I was really chuffed. And I was invited to a Lego store in London, and people were queuing up to get me to sign the box and everything. It was very surreal and an extremely proud moment of my life.
To see pictures of Thomas's delightful bird models, go to our website, birdnote.org. I'm Mark Bramhill.
We'll be right back. To listener-supported community radio, KBOO Portland.
Tune in this Monday at 11 p.m. as the bedtime radio show for grown-ups, Gremlin Time, presents By the Dawn's Early Light by Lawrence Block.
This is a case that shouldn't be in the first place, and I'd love to clear it up before they even go so far as presenting a bill to the grand jury.
So for me, you want?
Whatever you can find, Matt. I don't know what there is to be found. But you were a cop, and now you're a private. And you can get down on the streets and nose around.
Tune in this Monday at 11 p.m. Gremlin Times 3D radio players present an adaptation of Lawrence Block's short story, By the Dawn's Early Light, right here on Community Radio KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements.